Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so while we talk about recent developments impacting the public safety workplace. I have several cases that I want to talk about today. There's a notable decision from the Wyoming Supreme Court that focuses on the policies of the International Association of Firefighters with respect to the representation of volunteers. Coming out of Maryland, we have a case in another Brady List case. This is one where a police officer is trying to sue a prosecutor who, the officer claims, wrongly placed him on the Brady List. We'll talk about how that came out. Got a few other cases. But first, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring you up to date on the developments under Janus. Janus, of course, being the Supreme Court's June 27th decision in the case of Janus versus AFSCME, the decision that held unconstitutional compulsory fair share. What I want to do is bring you up to date on the various questions that seem to be emerging post-Janus, and how we see both employers and labor organizations addressing those questions. And very conveniently, I've come up with a list of 10 questions that I think will capture most of the discussion that's out there about Janus. So let's dive into it. First question, are dues deductions authorizations that were signed by fair share members prior to the Janus decision still valid, or do people who were formerly fair share members need to sign new authorization cards? Now, I'll answer the question, but before I do, I want to give you a caveat, and the caveat is there's absolutely no law on this, on any of what I'm about to talk about, because it's just too early yet. We don't have any court decisions. We don't have any decisions from labor boards. So what you're hearing from me is nothing more than unvarnished opinion that also summarizes what I see people doing in various places around the country. So back to the question. Do former fair share members need to sign new authorization cards after the Janus decision? And I think the overwhelming view is that the answer to that question is yes. And the reason for that answer is rooted in the Janus decision itself. Janus takes the position, the Supreme Court takes the position, that a labor organization and an employer have an obligation to prove by convincing evidence that an employee's fair share participation was voluntary. It's pretty easy to see an employee coming in and saying, hey, yeah, I know I signed that fair share card in 2017, but I only signed it then because the only alternative was fair share or full membership. That's not voluntary. And I think that sort of argument by an employee is probably going to resonate with the court. So the best practice, and I think the overwhelming practice that we're seeing out there, is that fair share members need to sign new authorization cards. By the way, implicit in my answer is a topic that has a little bit of confusion out there. Janus did not end fair share. I've heard that statement many times. That's not what the Supreme Court said. What the Supreme Court said was that fair share, as the only alternative to full membership, in other words, compulsory fair share, is not constitutional. You can have voluntary fair share. Unions can still decide that they want to have full members and fair share members, with fair share members not being entitled to all of the benefits of full members, but still paying something in dues in order to pay for the services that the union provides. So voluntary fair share is an option. The problem with these pre-Janus authorization cards is The only fair share that was an option before Janus was compulsory fair share. Okay, question number two. Which is derivative of question number one? Should employers unilaterally stop fair share deductions for non-members, fair share deductions that were authorized pre-Janus? And the answer there, I think, also lies in the roots of Janus. Under Janus, remember, the real lawsuit under Janus, it actually is a lawsuit against the employer. It's the employer that is taking the money out of the employee's paychecks to pay to the union by way of dues. So employers are technically on the hook for liability for illegal fair share contributions. And I think many employers, I don't want to go so far as to say most, because there's more diversity of practice on this issue than on the one with respect to authorization cards, but many employers are taking the position that we just simply don't know whether or not pre-Janus fair share members really wanted to be fair share members, so we're simply going to stop their dues deduction, their fair share dues deductions, until we receive new cards. Now, like I said, I've seen a lot of diversity of opinion on this one. I know many employers that are taking the position, we don't have to do anything. It's up to the employee to notify us that they really don't want fair share dues coming out of their paycheck. And I've also seen employers and unions work out an accommodation for this issue. And the accommodation is that the fair share dues will continue, and the union will agree that if the employer is sued, the union will defend and indemnify the employer from any liability associated with making the fair share deductions. So you see three different practices out here. You see some employers unilaterally ending pre-Janus fair share deductions. You see some employers totally ignoring the issue and doing nothing. And you see some employers taking the middle ground of continuing the deductions, but having their union sign defense and indemnification agreements. All right, also related, question number three. Assuming that an employer is not going to unilaterally end fair share deductions, are employers under an obligation to notify pre-Janus fair share members that they need to sign new authorization cards? And I think this is just simply a good, cautious practice by employers. After all, we do have constitutional rights that are at issue here, the Supreme Court tells us. These are non-members' First Amendment rights. If I'm an employer and I'm not going to unilaterally end fair share deductions, I am probably going to communicate with fair share members to see whether they want their fair share dues to continue to be withheld from their checks. You have to be careful how you write that letter, as I'll talk about a little bit more with respect to the question number four. Question number four, is an employer under an obligation to notify full members, pre-Janus full members, not fair share members now, full members, that they have the right to withdraw from the union or that they need to sign new authorization cards? I've seen only a few employers do this, and by and large, these are employers that don't really like dealing with their unions very much. The overwhelming practice here is that employers are not notifying pre-Janus full members of their rights to withdraw from the union, and there's a good reason that they're not doing that, because there is, I think, a very convincing argument that for an employer to tell a full member of the union, hey, you don't have to be a member of the union anymore, just tell us, and we'll stop your dues deductions I think there's a pretty good argument that is the unfair labor practice of interfering with the internal activities of the labor organization. It may well be other unfair labor practices as well. It may be a discrimination unfair labor practice. It may even be what's referred to as an end run or direct dealing unfair labor practice. Pick your poison on this one. This is a route that I think is fraught with peril for an employer. Okay, question number 5. Is there a need to reopen contracts that contain fair share clauses that are now unenforceable? Easy answer to this one. Yes, you should be getting rid of, whether you're a union or an employer, you should be getting rid of provisions in your collective bargaining agreements or memoranda of understanding that are now illegal. And compulsory fair share is now illegal in this country. What's the vehicle for addressing these contract clauses that need to be repaired? They either need to be taken out of the contract or converted into voluntary fair share clauses. The vehicle is through what's known as a savings clause in a collective bargaining agreement or MOU. This is one of these clauses at the end of the contract that pretty much nobody ever looks at, but they're in just about every contract. And what a savings clause says is that if any clause in the contract becomes unenforceable for any reason, the parties will agree to sit down and negotiate a substitute. So what we're seeing this all around the country right now, is either unions or employers are reopening contracts for the limited purpose of rewriting the dues deduction and membership clauses in their contracts. Question number 6. Do unions need to be doing a review of their constitutions and bylaws to deal with Janus and the end of compulsory fair share? Again, easy answer, yes, absolutely. A union should not be taking the risk of having in its constitution or bylaws, even if it has no fair share members. It should not take the risk of having unenforceable clauses in the bylaws. It just simply creates a potential for liability that need not exist. Now, a suggestion for labor organizations out there. When you're rewriting your constitutions or your bylaws to deal with the Janus issue, kind of in the while you're up department, why don't you do a head-to-tail review of your constitution and bylaws with an eye towards updating the document in order to account for changes in the law or changes, more likely, in your practices that have developed over the years. For example, do you do electronic voting in union elections? If you do, have you accounted for that in your constitution and bylaws? I could raise a dozen other questions that are like that. It's really a good idea for a union, usually about every other year or so, to do a stem-to-stern review of constitution and bylaws just to make sure that you're following the latest practices out there. The Janus decision provides you with this opportunity. All right, on to question number 7. What happens with all those fair share deductions that employers made from paychecks and then turned them over to unions prior to Janus? Are employers obligated to refund pre-Janus fair share contributions? Now, this is getting to be a bigger and bigger topic. As you'll hear me talk about a little bit later on, we have several conservative, they're either political action groups or they're think tanks, or they're all nonprofits. We have several of them that are now going around the country suing unions and employers derivatively to try to get unions to disgorge pre-Janus fair share payments. And the argument that these nonprofits are making is, look, at the time we only had the choice between fair share and full membership. We never would have joined. We, meaning whoever the front people are for the lawsuit, we never would have become fair share members had we known that that was not constitutionally permissible. These lawsuits have been filed, boy, to the best of my knowledge, in over a dozen states in the country. And so that raises the question, should employers and unions take the unilateral action of turning over their fair share payments that they received or deducted pre-Janus? And I think the answer to that is pretty clearly no. These lawsuits are almost certainly going to fail. And the reason for that is court's opinions, the Supreme Court's opinion, like in Janus, they're very, very, very rarely retroactive. And there is nothing in Janus itself that suggests that the opinion should be retroactive. And remember, at the time that all of these fair share payments were being deducted from employees' checks, at the time, there was a 33-year-old Supreme Court decision that had stood the test of time that held that compulsory fair share was constitutional. That's the decision that Janus overturned. So I don't think there's much chance, if at all, that these lawsuits are going to succeed, and I wouldn't be recommending to anybody that that fair share payments made pre-Janus be paid back to whoever the fair share members were. Question number eight. Are unions considering statutory changes or ordinance changes to deal with the post-Janus environment? And in particular, are they considering these sorts of changes, statutory changes if you bargain under a statewide collective bargaining law, ordinance changes if you bargain under a local ordinance, are they considering these changes to deal with the free rider problem? The free rider problem being that after Janus, unions have a duty of fair representation with respect to non-members. They have a duty of fair representation to people who never want to pay the union a cent for those services. And so what are unions doing about that issue? And that's clearly a reality unless there are some sort of statutory or ordinance changes. And the answer is there are bills in various places around the country to do one of two things. The first is to entirely exempt unions from the duty of fair representation with respect to non-members. The duty of fair representation is a creature of statute, actually usually court or labor board decisions interpreting a statute, but it is a creature of the underlying bargaining statute. It flows from the union's duty to act as the exclusive representative for bargaining unit members. You can, if you are a legislature or a city council or a county board of commissioners, you can exempt unions from the duty of fair representation for non-members. And there are bills floating around out there in the country. If you're interested, we'll post the text of such a statutory change. There are bills floating around that will do precisely that. It's a lot of debate in the union movement as to whether that's a good idea. Many of the national organizations, the AFSCME's, the SEIU's, the Teamsters of the world, some of those organizations don't like this statutory change for any of a variety of reasons. However, I found both police and firefighters to be much more interested in this sort of change than general employee unions. So that's one change that's out there. The second change, and again, there are examples around the country, we'll post one of them on our website, of allowing a statutory change that would allow what you could refer to as a pay-to-play model. And a pay-to-play model means, you know, you can be a non-member if you want, but if you want us, the union, to file a grievance on your behalf. Perhaps you've got a seniority dispute. Maybe you've been fired, and now you want us to file a grievance on your behalf and take it to arbitration. If you want us to do that, you're going to have to pay for our services. And the services, you know, typically are on a menu. We're going to charge you this much for a shop steward, this much for a trained board member, this much for an attorney. I think in the last podcast, I directed you to the website for the Las Vegas Police Protective Association. They've had a pay-to-play model there for some time. And their charges go up to $500 an hour for the union attorney. So that's what a pay-to-play system is. And what we are seeing is bills being introduced, ordinances being introduced, that would allow unions to have such a pay-to-play model. Now, when unions are thinking about this, they're starting, I think, to get pretty deep into the details. And there's a wonderful phrase that was coined by Brian Wilson, who's the president of the police association up in Anchorage. He calls it the yo-yo effect, and I didn't actually ask Brian for his approval to use his name here, but I'm sure it'll be okay. What Brian's describing as the yo-yo effect is somebody who says, hey, I'm not going to be a member. And then they go for 2 or 3 or 4 years or whatever. They're not a member. They don't pay anything to the union. They enjoy the full benefits of the contract, but they don't have any grievances or any problems. And then there are serious charges against the employee, serious charges that may result in a lengthy suspension or a termination. And the member or non-member then presents themselves at the union's door and says, oh, I see the light now. I want to be represented by the union. Can I start paying my whatever the union dues are per month? As it stands, unless unions are thinking in any different terms, they simply have to say, yes, you can come on in. What can deal with the yo-yo effect, potentially, is that when you have someone who's a non-member who decides they want to become a member, that they have to pay an initiation fee. Think of it as a variety of the pay-to-play system. It would be an initiation fee. It could theoretically be gradated based upon the employee's years of service. Theoretically, it could be a flat dollar amount or a percentage of whatever gross salary is. There are a lot of options as to what this kind of secondary initiation fee would look like. All of this by way of saying unions are starting to be very creative about the ways they are dealing with the free rider problem. And unless they find some way to deal with it, you're going to be in the situation where the money that is tendered to the union by full members, the dues of full voluntary members, will be used to pay for the services provided to non-members. Ultimately, I think that's going to be an intolerable situation for unions. Okay, question number 9. Are we starting to see legal defense plans compete with unions? This one's kind of subtle, it's complicated, and it may well suggest that there's going to be a huge inter-union almost debacle that is on the horizon unless we see some sort of accords being reached. What's going on here? All right. One of the things that unions are doing in response to Janus is beefing up their member-only benefits. And one of the member-only benefits that is possible is a legal defense plan that provides coverage for criminal charges or potentially for civil lawsuits against the employee. That can be member-only because that's not within the duty of fair representation of a union in most places. It wouldn't be a mandatory subject of bargaining for the union to propose that sort of thing. Therefore, it can be put out there as a member-only benefit. So what unions are doing in beefing up these member-only benefits is to encourage non-members to become full members. It's just simply an additional benefit that unions can provide to their members. But what if you have a legal defense plan out there on the side, not sponsored by the union, where the legal defense plan says, hey, if you want representation, you know, maybe if you want representation for criminal or civil cases, or maybe even if you want representation in disciplinary cases, we'll sell you insurance where we will provide you that representation, and you don't need to be a member of the union in order to buy this insurance. We'll sell it to you on an employee-by-employee basis. Pretty easy to see how, if that is the case, you could have legal defense plans actually in competition with unions, where legal defense plans would be undercutting a union's ability to represent the bargaining unit. Pretty easy to see that happen. Now, there's two major legal defense plans out there, at least in law enforcement circles. One is sponsored by the Peace Officers Research Association of California, PORAC, and the other is sponsored by the Fraternal Order of Police. They have very different policies as to whether or not they will sell legal defense coverage to individual members of a bargaining unit who might be represented by another union. PORAC will not do so. PORAC will only sell its legal defense insurance to the unions, and everybody is covered. The Fraternal Order of Police will sell its coverage to individual members of a bargaining unit so long as the member of the bargaining unit is a member of the FOP. And expect to see discussions probably at, I think, at least a statewide, if not a national level, about this issue as to whether legal defense plans like those two or others, you can anticipate others might come into the market, right? Others should be in the business of selling coverage to individual members of a bargaining unit. Last question, question number 10. Are the folks who've been behind the Janus decision, by this I mean these conservative think tanks and mega donors to the conservative think tanks, are they done? Are they done with coming after public sector unions? And the answer, I think, is clearly no, they are not done. There are three groups that are floating around out there that are still on the warpath against public sector unions. All three, get ready for a surprise, are funded in part by either the Koch brothers or foundations established by the Koch brothers. Not just the Koch brothers. There's a bunch of other people who have the same political views. And these are the groups, or at least one of them, is the group that provided the list of Supreme Court nominees to President Trump. So these are groups that are very well connected politically. The three groups are Americans for Prosperity, which has been around quite a long time. Then there is a group that is known as the Freedom Foundation. This is a new one. It's out of the state of Washington. And then lastly, there is the Mackinac Society out of Michigan. All three groups have set up web pages now to encourage union members to drop their union membership. You can go and you can type in the name of your union or the name of your employer. They have handy dandy forms that you can fill out that will notify the employer you don't want dues taken out anymore. In addition to that, you see lawsuits being filed by these sorts of groups around the country, as I mentioned earlier, trying to get unions to refund fair share payments that were made prior to Janus. Also, at least two of these groups is hiring, I think of them as unorganizers. They're not labor organizers. What they're trying to do is unorganize the labor movement. They're hiring people to make individual contact with union members, public sector union members around the country, and to encourage them to drop their union membership. And they're spending millions of dollars to do this. They're getting mailing lists that they get from employee lists that they then cross-reference against voter registration, and they're sending mail out to various public employees. They're making phone calls. This is a full-fledged attack on public sector unions that is not stopping with Janus. And what's it all about? Bottom line, it's all about partisan politics, right? The largest donors to the Democratic Party for many, many years have been labor organizations. The people who are supporting these nonprofits are not donors to the Democratic Party. And so this is just nothing more than full-fledged partisan politics, an attempt to defund labor organizations to achieve an overall political aim. So get ready. These folks may be coming to your neighborhood. They certainly have outwardly targeted several states, most of them on the West Coast. California, Oregon, and Washington, and Alaska are being explicitly targeted, as is New York. There's a New York-specific webpage from one of these groups. But they've made it clear they're going to go national. Okay, that's it on Janus. Let me move on to the cases. Okay, let's talk about that firefighter case from Wyoming that deals with the status of volunteers. First, a little bit of a backdrop. For the longest time, the International Association of Firefighters has looked askance, really, at the whole idea, the whole notion of volunteer firefighters. And that's really for the reason that it has been the IAFF's perception that volunteer firefighters take work away from paid firefighters. In fact, there's a section in the IAFF's Constitution, it's Article 15 of the Constitution, that actually defines as misconduct any individual in the IAFF who is guilty of, and I'm quoting here, acquiring or maintaining membership in any organization that advocates or encourages a rival organization, including volunteer fire departments or associations. So there's been this long-standing tension between the IAFF and volunteer fire departments, and that tension actually came to the fore in this Wyoming case. So what's going on there? In Wyoming, there is a state statute, that the state statute that governs collective bargaining for firefighters has a definition of firefighters. And the definition of firefighters is, and I'm quoting, paid members of any regularly constituted fire department. The statute goes on to say that anybody who is a firefighter within that definition has the right to collectively bargain with their employer, and they have the right to be represented by a bargaining agent with respect to wages, hours of work, and the like. So under that statute, that's the question where the issue arises as to whether or not a volunteer firefighter falls within the definition of firefighter for collective bargaining purposes. Now, the specific context of this case involved the city of Gillette in Wyoming, a town, it's called Wright, and also Campbell County. They all got together to form a Fire Protection Joint Powers Board that oversaw all of the fire protection in Campbell County, Wyoming. The department served 5,000 square miles, huge area, and it responds to about 2,000 calls for service each year. The department has 23 career firefighters and 200 volunteers. The volunteers don't have a set schedule, and if they have the right to turn down a shift, they get called, they can say, I'm not coming in, and there's no recriminations against them. They don't get sick leave or vacation leave. However, they do get compensated a bit for their efforts. Rather than a salary, they earn compensation on a per-incident basis and also for attending training and meetings. And the average that volunteers received in the most recent year, which was 2015, was $9.11 per hour. So in 2015, the career firefighters, the full-time firefighters, have a vote, and they select Local 5058 of the IAFF as its bargaining agent. Volunteers were not allowed to vote in the election, nor were they even asked whether they wanted to vote. The local 5058, once it gets a majority vote of the career firefighters, sends in a demand to bargain, and the board of this joint powers board, the board rejects the demand on the grounds that volunteers weren't involved in the election process, and a lawsuit results. That case is shortly thereafter joined by another case, this one involving the Jackson Hole Fire EMS Department, which had a similar structure of both paid employees and volunteers did get a bit of compensation, just like the volunteers in Campbell County. And the two cases are consolidated for hearing by the Wyoming Supreme Court. And the Wyoming Supreme Court focuses its opinion on the definition of firefighter and says, hey, legislature said a firefighter is a paid member of a fire department. These volunteers are paid. They're paid $9.11 an hour. That's the end of the issue, says the court. The legislature didn't say you have to be paid so much. The legislature didn't say you have to be a full-time career firefighter in order to get collective bargaining. Instead, the legislature just defined the word firefighter as somebody who is paid. Now, the IAFF had a bunch of arguments in this case. It actually brought one of its lawyers from Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. law firm that represents the international, brought her out to argue the case. They made a bunch of, I think, very creative arguments. One of them was that you can't interpret a statute that provides collective bargaining for career firefighters in the same way you would apply it to volunteers, because there is a difference in interests between full-time employees and volunteers. And the Wyoming Supreme Court was having none of that. The court answers that by saying, the record belies this contention and illustrates that the full-time and volunteer firefighters have numerous common interests. What are those common interests? Staffing, for example, safety, communication. These are all topics, says the Supreme Court, that apply to both full-time and career and volunteer firefighters. So the Supreme Court says, look, IAFF, your answer is not with us. If you want to exclude volunteers from collective bargaining, Your answer is in the legislature. You need to convince the legislature to rewrite the collective bargaining law to explicitly say that only full-time employees are eligible for collective bargaining. Will this decision encourage the IAFF to take a different view with respect to volunteers? Actually, that's a discussion that's been had out there for many years. You can find discussions of this on various FIRE blogs that are out there. And you can find the arguments pro and con, I think, very well set forth out there. However, my guess is you're not going to see a substantial easing of the IAFF's position, because the IAFF's underlying problem with representing volunteers remains unchanged, and that is volunteers, particularly when you start to pay them, and when you start to pay them a whole lot less than you pay a career firefighter, volunteers are in fact taking work away from full-time employees. And it's very easy to understand why the IAFF might just view this Wyoming case as a little blip in history and nothing that is worth changing a long-standing policy over. Let's turn to Maryland now, and the latest in a series of Brady cases involving a police officer who sues a prosecutor for, allegedly, wrongfully placing the officer on a Brady list. What's this case about? This is about Franklin Savage, and he works for the Pocomoke, Maryland Police Department. In 2012, he was assigned to the Worcester County Criminal Enforcement Team, which is one of these multi-jurisdictional drug interdiction task force. And in that capacity, in 2014, he attends a meeting. And this meeting is to discuss a possible prosecution. Members of the meeting include the state attorney's office, essentially the DA, and in particular, it included the state attorney, Bo Oglesby. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss a particular case in which a Savage had been the arresting officer, and during the meeting, Savage presents a number of letters that were written by the suspects for possible use in the upcoming court case. Oglesby then decides it's a good idea, decides it's a good idea to begin reading these letters verbatim, line for line, which meant, and now I'm quoting from the court's opinion, using the word nigga over and over again. Oglesby stops after he's reading this a little bit, and he asks whether or not he's offending anybody by reading these letters. I've got to pause there and say, gee, do you think? An assistant state attorney by the name of Ayeen Turnbull, who's the only African-American present other than Savage, left the room at that point. Savage remained, and Oglesby continued reading and continued using the word. A few months later, Savage resigns from this joint task force. He returns to the department, and he files a couple of complaints against Oglesby. One is with the EEOC, and the other is basically a bar complaint. He files it with the Maryland Attorney Grievance Commission. And both of these complaints say the same thing. Why is Oglesby repeatedly reading a racial slur during the April 2014 meeting? Oglesby's response to that is swift. Within a couple of months, he sends a letter to the Pocomoke City Mayor and City Council, and he says, because of what's happened, I'm going to be required to evaluate any case in which Savage would be a witness to determine what impact Savage might have on our ability to prosecute. Now, the bottom line of the letters, not explicitly, but implicitly, was, I'm not going to use Savage as a witness anymore. Well, Oglesby wasn't content with making that just implicit. He then makes a phone call to the city and is explicit. He tells the Pocomoke city manager that Savage will never be able to testify again and thus was, and I'm quoting, useless to the department. Oglesby apparently reiterates that Savage should be terminated, and in fact, 10 days later, Savage is fired. Savage sues Oglesby, he sues the city, views various officials, and he contends that Oglesby's conduct was, go figure, retaliation, and also race discrimination. Two other plaintiffs join the lawsuit. They're both African American, and they allege widespread race-based employment discrimination and retaliation in the city. Oglesby is very quickly dismissed from the case as a defendant, and then the federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals takes up the sole issue of, well, it's not the sole issue in the case, but the important issue they take up is whether Oglesby has any potential liability to Savage. Now, I want you to picture the setting of this case as it goes up to this federal court of appeals. Because the case has been dismissed, the court is required to assume that all of the facts alleged by Savage are true, that this meeting happened, that Oglesby repeatedly used this racial slur, that he recognized that the term he was using was offensive, and he kept on doing it, and then he went after and got Savage's job because Savage filed perfectly permissible complaints with the bar and with the EEOC. That's the context of this case. And the question the court has to decide is, assuming Oglesby's motivation was pure vindictive retaliation of the boldest sort, can he be sued? And the court says no. And the reason why is that prosecutors, say the court, are long entitled to prosecutorial immunity for decisions they make in the course of preparing for and presenting cases for prosecution. Prosecutorial immunity, says the court, is absolute immunity. Let me pause for a moment. There's two types of immunity under the law: absolute immunity and conditional immunity. Conditional immunity means the person is immune unless they do something to forfeit the immunity. The one that we think of very commonly is an immunity that appears in defamation cases, libel and slander cases, where someone is immune from making a defamatory comment about a public figure so long as they're not making it with malice. If they make that statement with malice, knowing it is false or having a very good reason to suspect that it is false, then they can be sued. They lose their conditional immunity by engaging in malice. I mean, we even had a movie, it starred Paul Newman once, that was called Absence of Malice. It was all about the notion of conditional immunity. Prosecutorial immunity is absolute immunity. And that means it can't be lost, period. It doesn't matter what the motivation is of a prosecutor for doing something. It can be the worst possible motivation, and the prosecutor still can't be sued for making that decision. It can be a decision to intentionally harm someone because they looked at you the wrong way in the parking lot that morning, and you can't be sued if the action taken by the prosecutor was in the normal course of a prosecutor's duties. The Fourth Circuit says what Oglesby did is covered by prosecutorial immunity. I'm going to read you the last three or so sentences in the court's opinion, which will explain its rationale. Decisions regarding witness testimony, says the court, which witnesses to call, whether potential witnesses are credible, and how to proceed in the face of credibility questions are a core prosecutorial function directly tied to the conduct of a criminal trial. This is clear from the Supreme Court, which has held that prosecutors are absolutely immune from claims that they knowingly presented false testimony at trial. Because the veracity of witnesses in criminal cases frequently is subject to doubt, the integrity of the criminal process would suffer if prosecutors were hampered in exercising their judgment as to the use of such witnesses by concern about resulting personal liability. End of case, says the Fourth Circuit. Oglesby, even though we are to assume that he retaliated deliberately against Savage for making a bar complaint and an EEOC complaint, and that he didn't have any questions about Savage's credibility before that, he was simply acting impulsively and out of spite, Oglesby is covered by prosecutorial immunity. And that's the way these cases come out. This isn't the first such case to be decided where the facts are seemingly incredibly egregious, and it won't be the last. The solution for officers who feel they have been wrongly placed on the Brady list is not a lawsuit against the prosecutor seeking damages. It is rather a lawsuit seeking to be removed from a Brady list or from the designation of a particular officer as being someone the prosecutor will never call. By the way, does this necessarily mean the end of an officer's job that a prosecutor has said, I'm not going to call this person as a witness? And the answer to that is increasingly no, it doesn't mean that. Courts and arbitrators are pretty routinely holding right now that if an employee is wrongfully placed on a Brady list or is designated as a do not call witness, that doesn't mean they lose their job if the employee did nothing wrong, if the employee wasn't dishonest or whatever the offense might be. What it means is the employer is going to have to find some other work for that employee to do, and that the employee shouldn't bear the brunt of a prosecutor's wrongful decision to place them on a Brady list. So it doesn't necessarily mean the end of the employee's job. But what's real clear right now is officers who feel they've been intentionally harmed by a prosecutor in the placement on a Brady list have no lawsuit for damages against the prosecutor. I want to finish this August podcast with a repayment of training costs case. These cases come up with some regularity. They come up in a variety of different contexts with different legal theories that you see advance from time to time. This one, which comes out of New Jersey, actually advances a legal theory I've never seen before, and the officer succeeded in prevailing against the employer in this case. So here's what happens factually in this case. The officer is a fellow named Kevin Marhefka, and he goes to work for the borough of Madison in New Jersey. When he takes his job, he gets a letter from the borough's administrator, and the letter says, if you decide to leave your job with us to accept another law enforcement position, you will be assessed the following penalties in accordance with relevant years of service. If you leave in the first year, you owe us $5,000. You leave in the second year, $4,000. Third year, $3,000. Fourth year, $2,000. If you stay with us 5 years and you leave, $1,000. After that, after 5 years, we're not going to come after you for any money. Marhefka signs the letter underneath the words acknowledged and accepted. He serves as a officer for the borough, apparently serves well, no discipline or anything like that. And then he got another job offer, this one from the township of Boonton, which is where he leaves. He resigns from Madison, takes the job with Boonton, and the borough promptly sues him, seeking to recover in his case, because he left within his first year, the borough wants $5,000. And the question that the New Jersey Court of Appeals has to decide is that contract enforceable? Now, I'll end this podcast by talking about different legal theories that have been raised in other cases, but let's focus on this legal theory, which, as I said, I've never seen before in one of these cases. And what the court says is, look, in New Jersey, we have a distinction between contract clauses that call for liquidated damages and contract clauses that call for penalties. What's liquidated what are liquidated damages? Liquidated damages are amounts that a party to a contract agree to pay if they break a promise. And liquidated damages are arrived at by a good faith effort to estimate in advance the actual damages that would result from the breach. It's really an attempt to quantify damages in advance that may not be easily quantifiable in the future. That's what liquidated damages are. And a penalty clause, says the court, is a sum that a party agrees to pay in the event of a breach, but isn't an attempt to estimate probable actual damages, but rather is a threat that is designed to prevent the breach of the agreement. The court says penalty clauses in New Jersey aren't enforceable. Liquidated damages are enforceable. And the court says the borough of Madison's contract that calls for, it's really kind of akin to a repayment of training costs contract, that's an unenforceable penalty. First, says the court, the administrator's letter explicitly says that it is imposing penalties in the event that Marhefka left his position within the first 5 years. We have to believe that the parties mean what they say. They use the word penalties. That's going to be the way it is. Second, says the court, the amounts that are assessed under this contract aren't a reasonable forecast of provable injury resulting from a breach. Why is it, for example, that if the officer leaves within 9 months of employment, that the penalty is $5,000? But if they leave 13 months of employment, it's only $4,000. How is that a forecast of the harm to the Bureau? And it actually isn't. The Bureau argues that the cost of losing the resigning officer would increase with the amount of the officer's experience. However, says the court, that's exactly the opposite of what the contract says, because here the amounts that are assessed under the contract decrease with the officer's experience. This strongly indicates, says the court, that the amounts assessed are penalties for early resignation rather than the forecast of harm to the Bureau. The court has another rationale for striking down this clause. It says, look, you know, even if this was a liquidated damages clause as opposed to a penalties clause, a liquidated damages clause to be enforceable has to concern damages that are difficult to estimate. That's not the case here, because the borough has come to us and said, look, when Marhefka resigned, we had to pay overtime to another officer to fill in for him. You can easily quantify how much overtime that you paid. There's no difficulty in estimating the harm that results to the Bureau. As such, the court strikes down the contract and holds that Marhefka has no obligation to repay the Bureau. Now, I've mentioned a couple of times that these repayment of training clause cases get litigated under other conditions. Most often, you see them arise in a bargaining context. And labor boards around the country I think our uniform, I don't recall a case to the contrary here. I can recall a whole bunch of them coming out the same way. Labor boards are pretty consistent in saying that a repayment of training clause contract, like the one of that Marhefka signed, that those concern mandatory subjects of bargaining. They concern wages because, of course, any amount that the employee has to repay is going to be deducted from wages or will offset wages that were earned. And they also concern freedom of movement of employment. Because they're mandatory subjects of bargaining, say these labor boards, any agreements like those must be with the union, not with individual members of the bargaining unit, such as Marhefka. To reach an individual agreement means you're engaged in a one-on-one contract with a member of the bargaining unit about something that's a mandatory subject of bargaining. You can't do that. That's the unfair labor practice of direct dealing. So that's another theory that you see that's attached sometime to these cases. Second theory is, what if, forget the union's situation now, let's say this is a non-union employee, or let's say the union signed off on the contract. What if the repayment of training costs obligation actually takes the employee below the minimum wage, because the repayment obligation is so onerous? And there are a couple of cases, not a lot, but a couple of cases that say that that would violate the Fair Labor Standards Act. So even if you can get over the liquidated damages penalty dichotomy, even if you can get over the direct dealing problem with these clauses, you have to be careful in how you write them so that you don't take the employee below the FLSA's minimum wage, or for that matter, the FLSA's overtime requirements. Let's say you can cross all three of these hurdles. Let's say you don't have the liquidated damages penalty problem, you don't have a union problem, you don't have an FLSA problem. Are these clauses enforceable? And the answer seems to be yes. When you see these cases typically coming out of the South, there's a very prominent one that comes out of Mississippi, where the court holds, in the absence of any other problems, these clauses are enforceable. That's it for this edition of First Thursday. Sorry I spent so long on the Janus stuff, but it has seemed to occupy so much of all of our time over the course of the last month. I mean, to the point where you're just simply tired of hearing about the issue. So that's why I spent a half hour on it in this podcast, is because I know you're all tired of listening to it. I promise in the September podcast, hopefully I won't even use the word Janus. We'll see. Don't hold me to that promise. We've got a seminar coming up in September in Las Vegas. This is our Grievances and Arbitration Seminar. Wonderful lineup of speakers, including an arbitrator, Margie Brogan, who is the former chair of the National Academy of Arbitrators, who will be talking about how an arbitrator interprets and applies a collective bargaining agreement in a grievance. We'll have what's become fairly usual for us right now, a counterpoint discussion between management and labor representatives, this one on disciplinary arbitrations. And I'll engage in a thorough, riveting, I promise you, riveting discussion of the day-to-day workings of a grievance procedure, how to pick arbitrators, what arbitration costs, what's the impact of past practice, and all of those sorts of related topics. You can register for the seminar by going to our website at LRIS.com. And with that, have a good remainder of the summer. I'll be back with you in September. This is Will Aitchison signing off.